Chapter 5. Armored Mind. Your knee looks pretty bad, Goggins.
No fucking shit, Doc.
With 2 days to go and walk week, I'd come by medical for a follow-up. The doctor rolled up my camo pants, and when he gave my right kneecap a gentle squeeze, pain seized my brain, but I couldn't show it. I was playing a role. I was the beat-up but otherwise healthy bud student ready for the fight, and I couldn't so much as grimace to pull it off. I already knew the knee was fucked, and that the odds of getting through another 5 months of training on one leg were low, but accepting another rollback meant enduring another hell week, and that was way too much to process. The swelling hasn't gone down much. How's it feel? The doctor was playing a role, too. SEAL candidates had a don't-ask-don't-tell agreement with most of the medical staff at Naval Special Warfare Command. I wasn't about to make the doctor's job easier by revealing anything to him, and he wasn't going to take caution's side and pull the ripcord on a man's dream. He lifted his hand and my pain faded. I coughed and pneumonia once again rattled in my lungs until I felt the cold truth of his stethoscope on my skin. Ever since Hell Week was called, I've been coughing up brown knots of mucus. For the first 2 days I lay in bed, day and night, spitting them into a Gatorade bottle, where I stored them like so many nickels. I could barely breathe, and couldn't move much either. I may have been a bad motherfucker in Hell Week, but that shit was over, and I had to deal with the fact that the devil, and those instructors, branded me too. "It's all right, Doc," I said. "A little stiff is all." Time is what I needed. I knew how to push through pain, and my body had almost always responded with performance. I wasn't going to quit just because my knee was barking. It would come around eventually. The doc prescribed medicine to reduce the congestion in my lungs and sinuses and gave me some Motrin for my knee. Within 2 days, my breathing improved, but I still couldn't bend my right leg. This would be a problem. Of all the moments and buds that I thought could break me, a knot-tying exercise never registered on my radar. Then again, this wasn't the fucking Boy Scouts. This was an underwater knot-tying drill held in the 15-foot section of the pool. And while the pool didn't strike mortal fear into me like it once did, being negatively buoyant, I knew that any pool evolution could be my undoing, especially those that demanded treading water. Even before Hell Week, we'd been tested in the pool. We had to perform mock rescues on the instructors and do a 50-meter underwater swim without fins on a single breath. That swim started with a giant stride into the water, followed by a full somersault to siphon off any momentum whatsoever. Then, without kicking off the side, we swam along the lane lines to the end of our 25-meter pool. On the far side, we were allowed to kick off the wall, then swim back. When I arrived at the 50-meter mark, I rose up and gasped for air. My heart hammered until my breath smoothed, and I grasped that I'd actually passed the first of a series of complicated underwater evolutions that were supposed to teach us to be calm, cool, and collected underwater on a breath hold. The knot-tying evolution was next in the series, and it wasn't about our ability to tie various knots or a way to time our max breath hold. Sure, both skills come in handy on amphibian operations. But this drill was more about our capacity to juggle multiple stressors in an environment that's not sustainable for human life. Despite my health, I was heading into the drill with some confidence. Things changed when I started treading water. That's how the drill began, with 8 students strung out across the pool, moving our hands and legs like egg beaters. That's hard enough for me on 2 good legs, but because my right knee didn't work, I was forced to tread water with just my left. That spiked the degree of difficulty and my heart rate, which sapped my energy. Each student had an instructor assigned to them for this evolution, and Psycho Pete specifically requested me. It was obvious I was struggling, and Psycho and his bruised pride were hungry for a little payback. With each revolution of my right leg, shock waves of pain exploded like fireworks. Even with Psycho eyeballing me, I couldn't hide it. When I grimaced, he smiled like a kid on Christmas morning. "Tie a square knot, then a bowline," he shouted. I was working so hard it was difficult to catch my breath, but Psycho didn't give 2 fucks. "Now, damn it!" I gulped air, bent from the waist, and kicked down. There were 5 knots in the drill altogether, and each student was told to grab their 8-inch slice of rope and tie them off one at a time at the bottom of the pool. We were allotted a breath in between, but could do as many as all 5 knots on a single breath. The instructor called out the knots, but the pacing was up to each student. We weren't allowed to use a mask or goggles to complete the evolution, and the instructor had to approve each knot with a thumbs up before we were permitted to surface. If they flashed a thumb down instead, we had to retie that knot correctly. And if we surfaced before a given knot was approved, that meant failure and a ticket home. Once back at the surface, there was no resting or relaxing between tasks. Treading water was the constant refrain, which meant soaring heart rates and the continual burning up of oxygen in the bloodstream for the one-legged man. Translation: the dives were uncomfortable as hell, and blacking out was a real possibility. Psycho glared at me through his mask as I worked my knots. After about 30 seconds, he'd approved both, and we surfaced. He breathed free and easy, but I was gasping and panting like a wet, tired dog. The pain in my knee was so bad, I felt sweat bead up on my forehead. When you're sweating in an unheated pool, you know shit's fucked up. I was breathless, low on energy, and wanted to quit. But quitting this evolution meant quitting Buds altogether, and that wasn't happening.
Oh no, are you hurt, Goggins? Do you have some sand in your pussy?
Psycho asked. I'll bet you can't do the last three knots on one breath. He said it with a smirk, like he was daring me. I knew the rules. I didn't have to accept his challenge, but that would have made Psycho just a little too happy, and I couldn't allow that. I nodded and kept treading water, delaying my dive until my pulse evened out, and I could score one deep, nourishing breath. Psycho wasn't having it. Whenever I opened my mouth, he splashed water in my face to stress me out even more, a tactic used when trainees started to panic. That made breathing impossible. Go under now or you fail. I'd run out of time. I tried to gulp some air before my duck dive and tasted a mouthful of Psycho's splash water instead as I dove to the bottom of the pool on a negative breath hold. My lungs were damn near empty, which meant I was in pain from the jump, but I knocked the first one out in a few seconds. Psycho took his sweet time examining my work. My heart was thrumming, like high-alert Morse code. I felt it flip-flop in my chest, like it was trying to break through my ribcage and fly to freedom. Psycho stared at the twine, flipped it over, and perused it with his eyes and fingers before offering a thumbs up in slow motion. I shook my head, untied the rope, and hit the next one. Again he gave it a close inspection while my chest burned and diaphragm contracted, trying to force air into my empty lungs. The pain level in my knee was at a 10. Stars gathered in my peripheral vision. Those multiple stressors had me teetering like a Jenga tower, and I felt like I was about to black out. If that happened, I'd have to depend on Psycho to swim me to the surface and bring me around. Did I really trust this man to do that? He hated me. What if he failed to execute? What if my body was too burned out that even a rescue breath couldn't rouse me? My mind was spun with those simple toxic questions that never go away. Why was I here? Why suffer when I could quit and be comfortable again? Why risk passing out or even death for a fucking knot drill? I knew that if I succumbed and bolted to the surface, my SEAL career would have ended then and there. But in that moment, I couldn't figure out why I ever gave a fuck. I looked over at Psycho. He held both his thumbs up and sported a big goofy smile on his face like he was watching a damn comedy show. His split second of pleasure in my pain reminded me of all the bullying and taunts I felt as a teenager. But instead of playing the victim and letting negative emotions sap my energy and force me to the surface, a failure, it was as if a new light blazed in my brain that allowed me to flip the script. Time stood still as I realized for the first time that I'd always looked at my entire life, everything I'd been through, from the wrong perspective. Yes, all the abuse I'd experienced and the negativity I had to push through challenged me to the core, but in that moment I stopped seeing myself as the victim of bad circumstance and saw my life as the ultimate training ground instead. My disadvantages had been callousing my mind all along and had prepared me for that moment in that pool with Psycho Pete. I remember my very first day in the gym back in Indiana. My palms were soft and quickly got torn up on the bars because they weren't accustomed to gripping steel. But over time, after thousands of reps, my palms built up a thick callus as protection. The same principle works when it comes to mindset. Until you experience hardships like abuse and bullying, failures and disappointments, your mind will remain soft and exposed. Life experience, especially negative experiences, help callus the mind. But it's up to you where that callus lines up. If you choose to see yourself as a victim of circumstance into adulthood, That callus will become resentment that protects you from the unfamiliar. It will make you too cautious and untrusting, and possibly too angry at the world. It will make you fearful of change and hard to reach, but not hard of mind. That's where I was as a teenager. But after my second hell week, I'd become someone new. I'd fought through so many horrible situations by then and remained open and ready for more. My ability to stay open represented a willingness to fight for my own life, which allowed me to withstand hailstorms of pain and use it to callus over my victim's mentality. That shit was gone, buried under layers of sweat and hard fucking flesh, and I was starting to callus over my fears, too. That realization gave me the mental edge I needed to outlast Psycho Pete one more time. To show him he couldn't hurt me anymore, I smiled back, and the feeling of being on the edge of a blackout went away. Suddenly I was energized, the pain faded, and I felt like I could stay under all day. Psycho saw that in my eyes. I tied off the last knot at leisurely pace, glaring at him the whole time. He gestured with his hands for me to hurry up as his diaphragm contracted. I finally finished, he gave me a quick affirmative and kicked to the surface, desperate for a breath. I took my time, joined him topside, and found him gasping, while I felt strangely relaxed. When the chips were down at the pool during Air Force pararescue training, I'd buckled. This time, I won a major battle in the water. It was a big victory, but the war wasn't over. After I passed the knot-tying evolution, we had 2 minutes to climb out onto the deck, get dressed, and head back to the classroom. During first phase, that's usually plenty of time. But a lot of us, not just me, were still healing from Hell Week and not moving at our typical lightning pace. On top of that, once we got through Hell Week, Class 231 went through a bit of an attitude adjustment. Hell Week is designed to show you that a human is capable of much more than you know. It opens your mind to the true possibilities of human potential, and with that comes a change in your mentality. You no longer fear cold water or doing push-ups all day. You realize that no matter what they do to you, they will never break you, so you don't rush as much to make their arbitrary deadlines. You know if you don't make it, the instructors will beat you down, meaning push-ups, getting wet and sandy, anything to up the pain and discomfort quotient. But for those of us knuckle-draggers still in the mix, our attitude was, so the fuck be it. None of us feared the instructors anymore, and we weren't about to rush. They didn't like that one damn bit. I had seen a lot of beatdowns while at Buds, but the one we received that day will go down as one of the worst in history. We did push-ups until we couldn't pick ourselves up off the deck. Then they turned us on our backs and demanded flutter kicks. Each kick was torture for me. I kept putting my legs down because of the pain. I was showing weakness, and if you show weakness, it is on. Psycho and SBG descended and took turns on me. I went from push-ups to flutter kicks to bear crawls until they got tired. I could feel the moving parts of my knee shifting, floating, and grabbing every time I bent it to do those bear crawls, and it was agonizing. I moved slower than normal and knew I was broken. That simple question bubbled up again. Why? What was I trying to prove? Quitting seemed the sane choice. The comfort of mediocrity sounded like sweet relief until Psycho screamed in my ear, "Move faster, motherfucker!" Once again, an amazing feeling washed over me. I wasn't focused on outdoing him this time. I was in the worst pain of my life, but my victory in the pool minutes before came rushing back. I'd finally proved to myself that I was a decent enough waterman to belong in the Navy SEALs. Heady stuff for a negatively buoyant kid that never took a swim lesson in his entire life. And the reason I got there was because I'd put in the work. The pool had been my kryptonite. Even though I was a far better swimmer as a SEAL candidate, I was still so stressed about water evolutions that I used to hit the pool after a day of training at least 3 times a week. I scaled the 15-foot fence just to gain after-hours access. Other than the academic aspect, nothing scared me as much about the prospects of Buds like the swimming drills, and by dedicating time, I was able to callus over that fear and hit new levels underwater when the pressure was on. I thought about the incredible power of a callous mind on task as Psycho and SBG beat me down, and that thought became a feeling that took over my body and made me move as fast as a bear around that pool. I couldn't believe what I was doing. The intense pain was gone, and so were those nagging questions. I was putting out harder than ever, breaking through the limitations of injury and pain tolerance, and riding a second wind delivered by a callous mind.
After the bear crawls, I went back to doing flutter kicks, and I still had no pain. As we were leaving the pool a half hour later, SBG asked, "Goggins, what got into your ass to make you Superman?" I just smiled and left the pool. I didn't want to say anything because I didn't yet understand what I now know. Similar to using an opponent's energy to gain an advantage, leaning on your callous mind in the heat of battle can shift your thinking as well. Remembering what you've been through and how that has strengthened your mindset can lift you out of a negative brain loop and help you bypass those weak, one-second impulses to give in so you can power through obstacles. And when you leverage a callous mind, like I did around the pool that day, and keep fighting through pain, it can help you push your limits, because if you accept the pain as a natural process and refuse to give in and give up, you will engage the sympathetic nervous system, which shifts your hormonal flow. The sympathetic nervous system is your fight or flight reflex. It's bubbling just below the surface. And when you are lost, stressed out, or struggling, like I was when I was a down-and-out kid, that's the part of your mind that's driving the bus. We've all tasted this feeling before. Those mornings when going on a run is the last thing you want to do, but then 20 minutes into it, you feel energized. That's the work of the sympathetic nervous system. What I've found is that you can tap into it on call, as long as you know how to manage your own mind. When you indulge in negative self-talk, the gifts of a sympathetic response will remain out of reach. However, if you can manage those moments of pain that come with maximum effort by remembering what you've been through to get to that point in your life, you will be in a better position to persevere and choose fight over flight. That will allow you to use the adrenaline that comes with a sympathetic response to go even harder. Obstacles at work and school can also be overcome with your callous mind. In those cases, pushing through a given flashpoint isn't likely to lead to a sympathetic response, but it will keep you motivated to push through any doubt you feel about your own abilities. No matter the task at hand, there is always opportunity for self-doubt. Whenever you decide to follow a dream or set a goal, you are just as likely to come up with all the reasons why the likelihood of success is low. Blame it on the fucked-up evolutionary wiring of the human mind. But you don't have to let your doubt into the cockpit. You can tolerate doubt as a backseat driver, but if you put doubt in the pilot seat, defeat is guaranteed. Remembering that you've been through difficulties before and have always survived to fight again shifts the conversation in your head. It will allow you to control and manage doubt and keep you focused on taking each and every step necessary to achieve the task at hand. Sounds simple, right? It isn't. Very few people even bother to try to control the way their thoughts and doubts bubble up. The vast majority of us are slaves to our minds. Most don't even make the first effort when it comes to mastering their thought process because it's a never-ending chore, impossible to get right every time. The average person thinks 2,000 to 3,000 thoughts per hour. That's 30 to 50 per minute. Some of those shots will slip by the goalie. It's inevitable, especially if you coast through life. Physical training is the perfect crucible to learn how to manage your thought process because when you're working out, your focus is more likely to be single-pointed, and your response to stress and pain is immediate and measurable. Do you hammer hard and snag that personal best like you said you would, or do you crumble? That decision rarely comes down to physical ability. It's almost always a test of how well you are managing your own mind. If you push yourself through each split and use that energy to maintain a strong pace, you have a great chance of recording a faster time. Granted, some days it's easier to do that than others, and the clock or the score doesn't matter anyway. The reason it's important to push hardest when you want to quit the most is because it helps you callous your mind. It's the same reason why you have to do your best work when you are the least motivated. That's why I loved PT and Buds, and why I still love it today. Physical challenges strengthen my mind, so I'm ready for whatever life throws at me. And it will do the same for you. You know, David, I think we should talk about this callous mind thing, man, because a couple things. Going back to the first reference of it, this idea of choosing whether you're going to use negativity to callous over your victim's mentality or to kind of solidify that and just make you hard to reach. I mean, that's like so fundamental. And so true.
Right. It truly is. And throughout my whole life, I was trying to find different ways to kind of get through life. And like I said, it is not a five-step process. You got to figure out what works for you. And I kept on seeing my hands becoming, you know, extremely calloused as I was trying to lose that weight, and I was doing tons of pull-ups and all this other stuff. And I was like, you know what? I need to do my brain the same way. And through repetition, through friction, you have to put obstacles in front of you. And that, you know, through friction is how you become better. So I kept on, and also through friction, friction was calloused in my hands.
Right.
So I had to kind of put friction on my mind. And that's exactly what I just kept on doing. I kept on putting friction on my mind.
I mean, but friction on the mind is a natural thing. And what you're saying is, I mean, the way I'm getting it is, you have to, but you can choose actually where you're going to allow that callus to happen when it comes to the mind. And the body, you don't have the choice. It's whatever you use. But the same is true of the mind. It's wherever you're putting your mind. So if you're saying, you know, listen, the world's giving me all sorts of grief and I'm fighting through it, but that's going to make me harder and better and stronger going forward, then that's, you're not being a victim. But if you're like, fuck all this, all these motherfuckers are beating me down, then all of a sudden you're going to isolate yourself with a callus.
Right. That's the only, and that's exactly right. A callus can work for you and a callus can work against you. So that's the only way you can look at every, you know, any situation that you're in, the only way you can look at it is, you know what? You're beating me down, but all you're doing is making me more of an animal. Mm. You're making me better. But once you take that other approach to it as, woe is me, why are you being this way to me? You know, but with all that being said, you have to look at the source. And we talked about it in the previous chapters. You have to look at the source of the person that's beating you down.
Mm.
Like, why is a secure individual going to take the time to beat you down? They're not going to. And we put so much into these people, like, oh my God, this person doesn't like me, or whatever the situation may be, versus taking the time to just slow it down and say, you know what? A secure human being wouldn't be doing that right now. So the problem isn't with you usually. The problem is with your adversary.
Right. But if it's someone's born poor, for instance, and their dad, they never met their mom or dad or someone, they've had to start from way back from the starting line. You could see how someone would think that the odds are stacked against them. You could forgive them for that. But the thing is, it is still a choice they're making.
Oh, 100%. I mean, it is now you to own.
Right.
You know, your parents may have put you in a fucked up situation. Once again, you have to turn that around yourself. No one is coming to save you. And that's, you know, we have this mentality of, I'm going to wait to be saved.
Mm.
I'm going to wait for someone to come and help me. And I'm telling you right now, I believe in God. A lot of us believe in praying on it and stuff like that. Yeah, you can pray on it, but if you sit in a room and pray on it and do nothing about it, nothing's going to happen. You have to put work behind everything in life. You have to put effort. You have to put friction behind something for something to change.
Yeah, and I mean, that gets back to the hero's journey and why this book is so important for everybody who's listening right now or reads the book, is to think of themselves in your shoes. Because what you like to say is, it just makes the story better. If you have certain disadvantages in a given situation, imagine how great the story is going to be when you fucking rock it.
Exactly. Like right now, I could be a 350-pound, you know, guy that works for Ecolab. And if I would have never found a way how to callous my mind, how to take souls, how to reach in there and find more of myself, I would be that same person who was spraying for cockroaches. You know, I would never know that inside that 300-pound body was a person that was capable of going through these hell weeks, that was capable of running, of doing anything I've done.
Mm.
You know, we don't want to examine the possibilities of what we can be. And that's the scariest thing in the world to me, is I believe that so many people have died never knowing what they could, you know, what they could have been.
Absolutely. I think that this also, what you say here that's so poignant, is that it's important for everyone to know that you don't have to get right. You don't have to get it right every time. Sometimes you're going to think wrong. Sometimes you're going to take the victim's way out at first. When, you know, this is a muscle you're building up. And like you say, the average person thinks 2,000 to 3,000 thoughts per hour, 30 to 50 per minute. I mean, you're not going to get them all.
Some you're gonna be lazy with the mind sometimes. I mean, I think about this all the time. I've been working with you for what? Almost, we're going on a year.
Right.
And I've been hearing this and I love it and I'm active. But you know, when I'm pushing hard running and it hurts and I actually don't remember to answer the simple questions all the time. It takes a lot of focus to actually be able to even answer that question. It's not easy. And so you're going to get it wrong sometimes, but that's okay. That's all part of the process.
It is all part of the process. And one thing I know is that you have to kind of imagine yourself after the fact. So what that means is, like this morning, I didn't feel like getting up and running. I didn't get much sleep. I stretched, you know, I was stretching for a couple hours, went to bed about 1:30. I was up at 6 this morning and went running. I knew that I would be here right now talking to you all, you know, doing this book. And the whole time I'd be in this little booth locked up in this little cage, I'd be thinking one thing. Why the hell didn't I go run? So you want to get to the point in your life where all these things that you don't do, they bother you. They haunt you. They eat at you throughout the whole day. If you miss something that you were supposed to do, if you're like, you know what? It's not a big deal. I'll do it tomorrow. You're not there yet. You want to get to the point in your life where everything that you should have done and you didn't do, it bothers you. And I know that going into everything. Last night, this morning, you know, I went to bed. I thought to myself, you know what? I might not run. I have time afterward. You know what? You can't do that. You cannot do that. So all this stuff right here, this is all about callousing your mind.
But no matter how well you deploy it, a calloused mind can't heal broken bones. On the mile-long hike back to the Buds compound, the feeling of victory evaporated, and I could feel the damage I'd done. I had 20 weeks of training in front of me, dozens of evolutions ahead, and I could barely walk. While I wanted to deny the pain in my knee, I knew I was fucked, so I limped straight to medical. When he saw my knee, the doc didn't say a damn thing. He just shook his head and sent me to get an x-ray that revealed a fractured kneecap. In Buds, when reservists sustain injuries that take a long time to heal, they're sent home. And that's what happened to me. I crutched my ass back to the barracks, demoralized. And while checking out, I saw some of the guys that quit during Hell Week. When I first glimpsed their helmets lined up beneath the bell, I felt sorry for them because I knew the empty feeling of giving up. But seeing them face to face reminded me that failure is a part of life, and now we all had to press on. I hadn't quit, so I knew I'd be invited back, but I had no idea if that meant a third Hell Week or not. Or if after getting rolled twice, I still had the burning desire to fight through another hurricane of pain with no guarantee of success. Given my injury record, how could I? I left the Buds compound with more self-awareness and more mastery over my mind than I'd ever had before, but my future was just as uncertain. Airplanes have always made me claustrophobic, so I decided to take the train from San Diego to Chicago, which gave me 3 full days to think. And my mind was all fucked up. Before we get into that, how did you become claustrophobic?
You know what? I don't talk about it much at all. It's a pretty messed up story for me. So when I was in the Air Force, they sent me to a school called Survival School. And it's mostly for pilots, you know, being trapped behind enemy lines and, you know, pilots become, you know, POWs, prisoners, you know, prisoner of war. So they sent me and a couple of guys to survival school. And the first couple of weeks, they teach you how to survive, out in the land, you know, out in the woods, how to make different shelters, how to eat, you know, different food, whatnot. But then the last week of survival school, they put you in this mock POW camp. So they put this hood over your head and you live in a slightly bigger sized coffin box. And so that was okay for me. I'm about 6'1", 6'2", and the actual box was about maybe 5'10", and it was probably about 3 feet wide. So I lived in that. But what they would do is they would take you from that box and they would put you in a very, very small box.
Hmm.
And so the whole time you have a hood over your head, so you can't see what the POW camp looks like. You can't see any of that stuff. So now they put me in a box. So imagine this. Imagine getting in a ball, you know, scrunching down the ball, having your chest up to your thighs, and getting as tight as you can. And they shove you in this box. And at this time, I was about 260 pounds. So they shove you in a box where your right elbow is touching the side, your left elbow, your head is touching the very top of the box, and your knees are touching the front of the box. And your back is also kind of rounded over to the top of the box and the back of the box. So you are literally smushed in this thing. So that wasn't too bad either. But what happened that made me seriously claustrophobic was I thought it was a game because, like I said, everything is a head game. But in this situation, it wasn't. In my box, there happened to be bees. And this wasn't part of the training. There was bees in the box. And I thought, okay, maybe these guys, these instructors are now trying to make me quit. And they're messing with me. And there was something tickling my neck. I'm like, okay, Goggins, keep it together. Keep your shit together, man. Keep it together. Because once you freak out and you're in that kind of tight box, you're going to panic and you're going to be like almost like the daggone Hulk trying to get out of that thing.
Mm.
So I started feeling something. I felt one bee sting, felt another bee sting. Before I knew it, I realized this was no longer a game. This was the real deal. And there was some bees in this box. So being trapped in there with these bees, it freaked me the hell out.
Hmm.
So I ended up getting through that thing, but I was trying to, you know, take a flight back from Washington, Spokane, Washington, and I had a flight to go back home. And I literally got to my first layover, and I was sweating. They had me in the corner by the window. You know, it was like, you know, it was like three seats, and I was by the window, and I was pinned into the side, and I was like, oh my God, I am claustrophobic. I'm seriously claustrophobic. So how I got over that was I had a buddy of mine who, well, I befriended this guy at the hospital, and I started literally going in and having him put me in the MRI machine after hours.
Hmm.
Because the MRI machine also freaked me out.
Hmm.
So how I got over it was just doing that. So that's how I became severely claustrophobic. But now I'm fine. I know how to talk to myself in the nice, tight, confined spaces.
So at this point, you still have it still lingering there, and you just, instead of talking yourself through it, you just wanted to think. So that's why you decided to take the train.
Yeah, not only did I want to think, I was like, I'm not getting that fucking airplane.
Yeah. You're like, not now.
No, not now. I was already busted up from too much shit. I didn't want to go through more mental torture.
So you're on the 3-day train ride. On the first day, I didn't know if I wanted to be a SEAL anymore. I had overcome a lot. I beat Hell Week, realized the power of a callous mind, and conquered my fear of the water. Perhaps I'd already learned enough about myself. What else did I need to prove? On day 2, I thought about all the other jobs I could sign up for. Maybe I should move on and become a firefighter. That's a badass job, and it would be an opportunity to become a different sort of hero. But on day 3, as the train veered into Chicago, I slipped into a bathroom the size of a phone booth, and checked in with the accountability mirror. Is that really how you feel? Are you sure you're ready to give up on the SEALs and become a civilian fireman? I stared at myself for 5 minutes before I shook my head. I couldn't lie. I had to tell myself the truth, out loud. I'm afraid. I'm afraid of going through all that shit again. I'm afraid of day 1, week 1. I was divorced by then. But my ex-wife, Pam, met me in the train station to drive me home to my mother's place in Indianapolis. Pam was still living in Brazil. We'd been in touch while I was in San Diego, and after seeing each other through the crowd on the train platform, we fell back on our habits, and later that night, we fell into bed. That whole summer, from May to November, I stayed in the Midwest, healing up, then rehabbing my knee. I was still a reservist, but remained undecided about going back to Navy SEAL training. I looked into the Marine Corps. I explored the application process for a handful of firefighting units, but finally picked up the phone, ready to call into the Buds compound. They needed my final answer. I sat there, holding the telephone, and thought about the misery of SEAL training. Shit, you run 6 miles a day just to eat, not including your training runs. I visualized all the swimming and paddling, carrying heavy-ass boats and logs on our heads, over the berm all day. I flashed onto hours of sit-ups, push-ups, flutter kicks, and the O-course. I remembered the feeling of rolling around in the sand, of being chafed all fucking day and night. My memories were a mind-body experience, and I felt the cold deep in my bones. A normal person would give up. They'd say, fuck it, it's just not meant to be, and refuse to torture themselves 1 minute more. But I wasn't wired normal. As I dialed the number, negativity rose up like an angry shadow. I couldn't help but think that I was put on this earth to suffer. Why wouldn't my own personal demons, the fates, God, or Satan, just leave me the fuck alone? I was tired of trying to prove myself, tired of callousing my mind. Mentally, I was worn to the nub. At the same time, being worn the fuck down is the price of being hard, and I knew if I quit, those feelings and thoughts wouldn't just go away. The cost of quitting would be lifelong purgatory. I'd be trapped in the knowing that I didn't stay in the fight to the bitter end. There is no shame in getting knocked out. The shame comes when you throw in the motherfucking towel. And if I was born to suffer, then I may as well take my medicine. The training officer welcomed me back and confirmed that I was starting from day one, week one. As expected, my brown shirt would have to be swapped out for a white one, and he had one more sliver of sunshine to share. "Just so you know, Goggins," he said, "this will be the last time we will allow you to go through Bud's training. If you get injured, that's it. We will not allow you to come back again." "Roger that," I said. Class 235 would muster in just 4 weeks. My knee still wasn't all the way right, but I'd better be ready because the ultimate test was about to begin. Within seconds of hanging up the phone, Pam called and said she needed to see me. It was good timing. I was leaving town again, hopefully for good this time, and I needed to level with her. We'd been enjoying one another, but it was always a temporary thing for me. We'd been married once, and we were still different people with totally different worldviews. That hadn't changed, and obviously neither had some of my insecurities, as they kept me going back to what was familiar. Insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. We would never work, and it was time to say so. She got to her news first. "I'm late," she said, as she burst through the door, clutching a brown paper bag. Like, late, late. She seemed excited and nervous as she disappeared into the bathroom. I could hear that bag crinkle and the tearing open of a package as I lay on my bed staring at the ceiling. Minutes later, she opened the bathroom door, a pregnancy test in her fists, and a big smile on her face. "I knew it," she said, biting her lower lip. "Look, David, we're pregnant." I stood up slow. She hugged me with everything she had, and her excitement broke my heart. It wasn't supposed to go like this. I wasn't ready. My body was still broken. I was $30,000 in credit card debt and still only a reservist. I had no address of my own and no car. I was unstable, and that made me very insecure. Plus, I wasn't even in love with this woman. That's what I said to myself while I stared into that accountability mirror over her shoulder, the mirror that never lies. I averted my eyes. Pam went home to share the news with her parents. I walked her to the door of my mother's place, then slumped into the couch. In Coronado, I felt like I'd come to terms with my fucked-up past and found some power there, and here I was, sucked under once again. Now it wasn't just about me and my dreams of becoming a SEAL. I had a family to think about, which raised the stakes that much higher. If I failed this time, it wouldn't mean that I was just going back to ground zero, emotionally and financially, but I would be bringing my new family there with me. When my mother got home, I told her everything. And as we talked, the dam broke, and my fear, sadness, and struggle came bursting out of me. I put my head in my hands and sobbed. "Mom, my life from the time I was born until now has been a nightmare. A nightmare that keeps getting worse," I said. "The harder I try, the harder my life becomes." "I can't argue with that, David," she said. "My mom knew hell, and she wasn't trying to baby me. She never had. But I also know you well enough to know that you will find a way to get through this." "I have to," I said, as I wiped the tears from my eyes. "I don't have a choice." She left me alone, and I sat on that couch all night. I felt like I'd been stripped of everything, but I was still breathing, which meant I had to find a way to keep going. I had to compartmentalize doubt and find the strength to believe that I was born to be more than some tired-ass Navy SEAL reject. After Hell Week, I'd felt I had become unbreakable, yet within a week, I'd been zeroed out. I hadn't leveled up after all. I still wasn't shit, and if I was going to fix my broke-down life, I would have to become more. On that sofa, I found a way. By then, I'd learned how to hold myself accountable, and I knew I could take a man's soul in the heat of battle. I had overcome many obstacles and realized that each of those experiences had calloused my mind so thick I could take on any challenge. All of that made me feel like I'd dealt with my past demons, but I hadn't. I'd been ignoring them. My memories of abuse at the hands of my father, of all those people who called me nigger, didn't vaporize after a few victories. Those moments were anchored deep in my subconscious, and as a result, my foundation was cracked. In a human being, your character is your foundation. And when you build a bunch of successes and pile up even more failures on a fucked up foundation, the structure that is the self won't be sound. To develop an armored mind, a mindset so calloused and hard that it becomes bulletproof, you need to go to the source of all your fears and insecurities. Most of us sweep our failures and evil secrets under the rug, but when we run into problems, that rug gets lifted up and our darkness reemerges, floods our soul, and influences the decisions which determine our character. My fears were never just about the water, and my anxieties towards class 2-3-5 weren't about the pain of first phase. They were seeping from the infected wounds I'd been walking around with my entire life, and my denial of them amounted to a denial of myself. I was my own worst enemy. It wasn't the world, or God, or the devil that was out to get me. It was me. I was rejecting my past, and therefore rejecting myself. My foundation, my character, was defined by self-rejection. All my fears came from that deep-seated uneasiness I carried with being David Goggins, because of what I'd gone through. Even after I'd reached a point where I no longer cared about what others thought of me, I still had trouble accepting me. Anyone who is of sound mind and body can sit down and think of 20 things in their life that could have gone differently, where maybe they didn't get a fair shake, and where they took the path of least resistance. If you're one of the few who acknowledge that, want to callous those wounds and strengthen your character, it's up to you to go back through your past and make peace with yourself by facing those incidents and all of your negative influences and accepting them as weak spots in your own character. Only when you identify and accept your weaknesses will you finally stop running from your past. Then those incidents can be used more efficiently as fuel to become better and grow stronger. Right there on my mom's couch, as the moon burned its arc in the night sky, I faced down my demons. I face myself. I couldn't run from my dad anymore. I had to accept that he was part of me and that his lying, cheating character influenced me more than I cared to admit. Before that night, I used to tell people that my father had died rather than tell the truth about where I came from. Even in the SEALs, I trotted out that lie. I knew why. When you get beat up, you don't want to acknowledge getting your ass kicked. It doesn't make you feel very manly, so the easiest thing to do is forget about it and move on. Pretend it never happened. Not anymore. Going forward, it became very important for me to rehash my life, because when you examine your experiences with a fine-tooth comb, you see where your issues come from. You can find strength in enduring pain and abuse. By accepting Trunis Goggins as part of me, I was free to use where I came from as fuel. I realized that each episode of child abuse that could have killed me made me tough as hell and as sharp as a samurai's blade. True, I had been dealt a fucked-up hand. But that night, I started thinking of it as running a 100-mile race with a 50-pound ruck on my back. Could I still compete in that race, even if everyone else was running free and easy, weighing 130 pounds? How fast would I be able to run once I'd shed that dead weight? I wasn't even thinking about ultras yet. To me, the race was life itself. And the more I took inventory, the more I realized how prepared I was for the fucked-up events yet to come. Life had put me in the fire, taken me out, and hammered me repeatedly. And diving back into the Bud's cauldron, feeling a third hell week in a calendar year, would decorate me with a PhD in pain. I was about to become the sharpest sword ever made. I mean, there's so much to dive into here, but I just want to unpack one specific thing, because it's a subtle difference. Because when you're in the pool, you realize that your hard life, everything you'd been through had calloused you to the point where you could take more pain and do and achieve more.
Right.
You'd been trained. You'd had that callous in your mind to be able to endure more pain. But now we're saying, actually, even though that is true and you had realized that, you actually hadn't accepted all those negative experiences completely. You accepted them as these things that you had to go through, these thresholds you had to pass through, but you didn't accept them as integral to your character. Is that right?
Exactly. So what I did was, yeah, I was definitely getting, I was enduring the pain. I was getting better in the water. I was getting better physically. And that's the thing about it, man. It's like a lot of times, for instance, I was at Bud's Prep for a while before I got out of the SEAL teams, before I retired. And what I saw was we were teaching these guys, you know, we were building these hybrids. And these guys would come to this program straight out of boot camp. And they spent 2 months training for Buds, something that we never did before. Like when I went through, you got orders and went right to Buds. Now we were getting these guys ready for Buds. So it was 2 months of pre-Buds, of getting your ass kicked. So we got these guys more push-ups, more sit-ups, more swimming, more everything. But what I realized, though, is all we were doing was building a bigger, stronger, faster quitter. We never went down to the fucking straight up foundation of that person's soul. So that's what I was doing here. Every time I would overcome something, I thought, oh my God, my past is in the dust. My past is gone. I'm crushing this shit. But what I never did was I never drilled down deep. I never drilled down deep. I never went back to my past and actually sat down with the old David Goggins. The David Goggins that got abused by his dad. The David Goggins that got called nigger. I just thought that me getting better was enough. I said, oh my God, look where I'm at now. I've overcome so much. But whenever hard times would come up, like, you know, like we talk about here, that rug would lift. And once that rug would lift, all those demons would come flying out. So I had to go back and actually face all of that shit. Go back in my past and literally rebuild that foundation.
And it's really interesting because basically all you're doing now in telling your story with this book, but also in all the countless hours you spend telling your story on stage or on podcasts is basically all an outgrowth of that, isn't it? It's a full acceptance. So therefore you can use it to empower you in so many ways, whether it's in PT or in, you know, actually, In your case, it's actually empowered you to tell your story, and it's become its own livelihood.
Right, and I found great strength in doing that. So what I once feared anybody knowing what they're hearing right now. This is all embarrassing shit. But I got to the point where I realized, man, there's power. There's power in being able to tell the whole world, if they want to listen, anything they want to know about you. There's a lot of power. Not many people can do that. But once you get to that point in your life, you have cracked the code. You've cracked the code and you no longer look at people as, oh my God, they're judging me. Oh my God, what are they saying about me? There's a lot of people that say that, oh, I don't give a fuck. I don't care, whatever, man. But they care. They truly care. I got to the point where, judge me if you want. I truly don't care.
It's interesting though, because, I mean, we're going to talk about this later as well, but I think it's important for your readers and listeners to understand. I think when they first hear about you and what we're about to talk about in this chapter, I mean, it's absolutely amazing what you can withstand physically or what you did withstand in your life. But in reality, like, this is not some alpha male macho story.
No.
This is actually extreme vulnerability disguised as that. And I think that's so what's so interesting and why people are so attracted to you, your story and what you're doing is that you're giving permission to be vulnerable with yourself. It's actually a very sensitive thing to do. And most people don't have that sensitivity. They don't want to look at those weak points. It makes them feel weak, like you said. And you're giving them permission to do that. Because you found if you allow yourself to be weak, then you can become so much stronger.
That's exactly the truth. So that's what I found out in me being able to admit my faults, admit my weaknesses, admit my, you know, just admit my insecurities, admit my fears. I found great strength in owning that. We hate owning that. And like you said, you're going to hear in this next part of this chapter about some crazy shit. Like some stuff, even me looking back on it, me reading it, me talking about it with you for months, it's even hard for me to sometimes believe. And people love putting a title on what they don't understand. A lot of people love putting a title on me. Oh man, you just gotta have, you have some special brain. You guys have heard my life, at least a fraction of it. There's a lot more to come. Don't put a title on me to make yourself feel better. Do not put a title on me to give yourself a get out of jail free card. I am being vulnerable to you right now. I'm telling you where I come from. I'm telling you my parents. I'm telling you, you know, my learning disabilities, all the issues I had.
Wetting the bed
for a long time. Thanks for bringing that up, Adam. I appreciate that. You know, wetting the bed for a while, sleeping on the floor, having so many fears and insecurities that, you know, I lied so people would accept me. I'm telling you right now, if you put a title on me, you're afraid to face who you are. There is no excuse to be where you're at if you're not where you want to be.
Yeah, and just to encourage you listeners and readers to do this hard work for yourself, because that's what you're encouraging people to do, and so that you can find your strength, your reservoir of strength in it. I think that's just so important. And like, just to remind the world again, this is not some macho man alpha male story. It's a person who has become so vulnerable that this hero emerged. And that's kind of what we're talking about here.
And all we're trying to get is, I'm hoping that you become your own hero.
Yeah.
And I cannot say that enough, man. This is my story, but hopefully you all are at home right now rewriting your book. Rewriting your chapters of your life. Change the outlook. Change how you look at everything in life. It is possible.
That said, what you're about to hear is some crazy shit. and I will say that, you know, I'm not going to say the two episodes that when I first heard your story on Rich Roll's podcast ages ago.
Right.
This right here is one of the things that just made me like, go, that's mental. Like, that's fucking crazy. But crazy in a way that, wow, I didn't know that was possible for a human being. And hearing it in detail has just reinforced that. This is some amazing stuff right here.
I had to be open-minded, man. I had to be open-minded.
I showed up to class 235 on a mission and kept to myself throughout much of first phase. There were 156 men in that class on day one. I still led from the front, but I wasn't about shepherding anyone through Hell Week this time. My knee was still sore, and I needed to put every ounce of energy into getting my ass through BUDS. I had everything riding on the next 6 months, and I had no illusions about how difficult it would be to make it through. Case in point, Sean Dobbs. Dobbs grew up poor in Jacksonville, Florida. He battled some of the same demons I did, and he came into class with a chip on his shoulder. Right away, I could see he was an elite natural athlete. He was at or near the front on all the runs. He blitzed the O course in 8 minutes and 30 seconds after just a few reps, and he knew he was a bad motherfucker. Then again, like the Taoists say, those that know don't speak, and those who speak, well, they don't know jack shit. On the night before Hell Week began, he talked a lot of noise about the guys in class 235. There were already 55 helmets on the grinder, and he was sure he'd be one of the handful of graduates at the end. He mentioned the guys he knew would make it through Hell Week, and also talked a lot of nonsense about the guys he knew would quit. He had no clue that he was making the classic mistake of measuring himself against others in his class. When he beat them in an evolution or outperformed them during PT, he took a lot of pride in that. It boosted his self-confidence and his performance. In BUDS, it's common and natural to do some of that. It's all part of the competitive nature of the alpha males who are drawn to the SEALs. But he didn't realize that during Hell Week, you need a solid boat crew to survive, which means depending upon your classmates, not defeating them. While he talked and talked, I took notice. He had no idea what was in store for him and how bad sleep deprivation and being cold fucks you up. He was about to find out. In the early hours of Hell Week, he performed well, but that same drive to defeat his classmates in evolutions and on timed runs came out on the beach. At 5'4" and 188 pounds, Dobbs was built like a fire hydrant. But since he was short, he was assigned to a boat crew of smaller guys, referred to as Smurfs by the instructors. In fact, Psycho Pete made them draw a picture of Papa Smurf on the front of their boat just to fuck with them. That's the kind of thing our instructors did. They looked for any way to break you, and with Dobbs, it worked. He didn't like being grouped up with guys he considered smaller and weaker, and took it out on his teammates. Over the next day, he would grind his own crew down before our eyes. He took up the position at the front of the boat, or the log, and set a blistering pace on the runs. Instead of checking in with his crew and holding something back in reserve, he went all out from the jump. I reached out to him recently, and he said he remembered Buds like it happened last week. "I was grinding an axe on my own people," he said. "I was purposely beating them down, almost like if I made guys quit, it was a checkmark on my helmet." By Monday morning, he'd done a decent job of it. Two of his guys had quit, and that meant four smaller guys had to carry their boat and log by themselves. He admitted he was fighting his own demons on that beach, that his foundation was cracked. "I was an insecure person with low self-esteem trying to grind an axe," he said, "and my own ego, arrogance, and insecurity made my own life more difficult." Translation: his mind broke down in ways he'd never experienced before or since. On Monday afternoon, we did a bay swim, and when he emerged from the water, he was hurting. Watching him, it was obvious he could barely walk, and that his mind was teetering on the brink. We locked eyes, and I saw that he was asking himself those simple questions and couldn't find an answer. He looked a lot like I did when I was in pararescue, searching for a way out. From then on, Dobbs was one of the worst performers on the whole beach, and that fucked him up bad. "All the people I categorized as lower than worms were kicking my butt," he said. Soon his crew was down to two men, and he got moved to another boat crew with taller guys. When they lifted the boat head high, he wasn't even able to reach that motherfucker. And all of his insecurities about his size and his past started caving in on him. "I started to believe that I didn't belong there," he said, "that I was genetically inferior. It was like I had superpowers and I'd lost them. I was in a place in my mind I'd never been, and I didn't have a roadmap." Think about where he was at that time. This man had excelled through the first few weeks of Buds. He'd come from nothing and was a phenomenal athlete. He had so many experiences along the way he could have leaned on. He'd calloused his mind plenty, but because his foundation was cracked, when shit got real, he lost control of his mindset and became a slave to his self-doubt. On Monday night, Dobbs reported to medical, complaining about his feet. He was sure he had stress fractures, but when he took off his boots, they weren't swollen or black and blue like he'd imagined. They looked perfectly healthy. I know that because I was at MedCheck too, sitting right beside him. I saw his blank stare and knew the inevitable was near. It was the look that comes over a man's face after he surrenders his soul. I had the same look in my eyes when I quit pararescue. What will forever bond me and Sean Dobbs is the fact that I knew he was going to quit before he did. The docs offered him Motrin and sent him back into the suffering. I remember watching Sean lace his boots, wondering at what point he would finally break. That's when SBG pulled up in his truck and yelled, "This will be the coldest night that you will ever experience in your entire lives." I was under my boat with my crew, headed back toward the infamous Steel Pier, when I glanced behind me and saw Sean in the back of SBG's warm truck. He'd surrendered. Within minutes, he would toll the bell three times and place his helmet down. In Dobbs' defense, this was one nightmare of a hell week. It rained all day and all night, which meant you never got warm and never got dry. Plus, somebody in command had the brilliant idea that the class shouldn't be fed and watered like kings at chow. Instead, we were supplied cold MREs for almost every meal. They thought that would test us even more, make it more like a real-world battlefield situation. It also meant there was absolutely no relief, and without abundant calories to burn, it was hard for anybody to find the energy to push through pain and exhaustion, let alone keep warm. Yes, it was miserable, but I fucking loved it. I thrived off the barbaric beauty of seeing the soul of a man destroyed,
only to rise again and overcome every obstacle in his path. By my third go-round, I knew what the human body could take. I knew what I could take, and I was feeding off that shit. At the same time, my legs didn't feel right, and my knee had been barking since day one. So far, the pain was something I could handle for at least a couple more days. But the thought of injury was a whole different piece of fuck you pie that I had to block out of my mind. I went into a dark place where there was just me and the pain and suffering. I didn't focus on my classmates or my instructors. I went full caveman. I was willing to die to make it through that motherfucker. I wasn't the only one. Late on Wednesday night, with 36 hours to go before the end of Hell Week, tragedy hit Class 235. We were in the pool for an evolution called the Caterpillar Swim, in which each boat crew swam on their backs, legs locked around torsos in a chain. We had to use our hands in concert to swim. We mustered up at the pool. There were just 26 guys left, and one of them was named John Scop. Mr. Scop was a specimen at 6'2" and 225 pounds, but he'd been sick from breakout and had been in and out of med check all week. While 25 of us stood at attention on the pool deck, swollen, chafed, and bleeding, he sat on the stairs by the pool, jackhammering in the cold. He looked like he was freezing, but waves of heat poured off his skin. His body was a radiator on full blast. I could feel him from 10 feet away. I'd had double pneumonia during my first Hell Week and knew what it looked and felt like. His alveoli, or air sacs, were filling with fluid. He couldn't clear them, so he could barely breathe, which exacerbated this problem. When pneumonia goes uncontrolled, it can lead to pulmonary edema, which can be deadly, and he was halfway there. Sure enough, during the caterpillar swim, his legs went limp, and he darted to the bottom of the pool like a doll stuffed with lead. Two instructors jumped in after him, and from there it was chaos. They ordered us out of the water and lined us up along the fence with our backs facing the pool as medics worked to revive Mr. Scop. We heard everything and knew his chances were slipping. 5 minutes later, he still wasn't breathing, and they ordered us to the locker room. Mr. Scop was transported to the hospital, and we were told to run back to the Buds classroom. We didn't know it yet, but Hell Week was already over. Minutes later, SBG walked in and delivered the news cold. "Mr. Scop is dead," he said. He took stock of the room. His words had been a collective gut punch to men who were already on the knife's edge after nearly a week with no sleep and no relief. SBG didn't give a fuck. "This is the world you live in. He's not the first, and he won't be the last to die in your line of work." He looked over at Mr. Scop's roommate and said, "Mr. Moore, don't steal any of his shit." Then he left the room like it was just another fucked up day. I felt torn between grief, nausea, and relief. I was sad and sick to my stomach that Mr. Scop had died, but we were all relieved to have survived Hell Week. Plus, the way SBG handled it was straight ahead, no bullshit. And I remember thinking if all SEALs were like him, this would definitely be the world for me. Talk about mixed emotions. See, most civilians don't understand that you need a certain level of callousness to do the job we were being trained to do. To live in a brutal world, you have to accept cold-blooded truths. I'm not saying it's good. I'm not necessarily proud of it. But Special Ops is a calloused world, and it demands a calloused mind. Hell Week had ended 36 hours early. There was no pizza or brown shirt ceremony on the grinder, but 25 men out of a possible 156 had made it. Once again, I was one of the few, and once again, I was swollen like a Pillsbury doughboy and on crutches with 21 weeks of training still to come. My patella was intact, but both of my shins were slivered with small fractures. It gets worse. The instructors were surly because they'd been forced to call Hell Week prematurely, so they ended Walk Week after just 48 hours. By every conceivable metric, I was fucked. When I moved my ankle, my shins were activated, and I felt searing pain, which was a monumental problem because a typical week in Buds demands up to 60 miles of running. Imagine doing that on two broken shins. Most of the guys in Class 235 lived on base at Naval Special Warfare Command in Coronado. I lived about 20 miles away in a $700 a month studio apartment with a mold problem in Chula Vista, which I shared with my pregnant wife and stepdaughter. After she got pregnant, Pam and I remarried. I financed a new Honda Passport, which put me roughly $60,000 in debt, and the three of us drove out from Indiana to San Diego to restart our family. I just cleared Hell Week for the second time in a calendar year, and she was set to deliver our baby right around graduation. But there was no happiness in my head or my soul. How could there be? We lived in a shithole that was at the edge of affordability, and my body was broken once again. If I couldn't make it through, I wouldn't even be able to afford rent. We'd have to start all over and find a new line of work. I could not and would not let that happen. The night before first phase kicked back up in intensity, I shaved my head and stared into my reflection. For almost 2 years straight, I'd been taking pain to the extreme and coming back for more. I'd succeeded in spurts, only to be buried alive in failure. That night, the only thing that allowed me to continue pushing forward was the knowledge that everything I'd been through had helped callous my mind. The question was, how thick was the callous? How much pain could one man take? Did I have it in me to run on broken legs? I woke up at 3:30 the next morning and drove to the base. I limped to the Bud's cage where we kept our gear and slumped onto a bench, dropping my backpack at my feet. It was dark as hell inside and out, and I was all alone. I could hear the rolling surf in the distance as I dug through my dive bag. Buried beneath my dive gear were two rolls of duct tape. I could only shake my head and smile in disbelief as I grabbed them, knowing how insane my plan was. I carefully pulled a thick black tube sock over my right foot. The shin was tender to the touch, and even the slightest twitch of the ankle joint registered high on the suffering scale. From there, I looped the tape around my heel, then up over my ankle and back down to my heel, eventually moving both down the foot and up my calf until my entire lower leg and foot were wrapped tight. That was just the first coat. Then I put another black tube sock on and taped my foot and ankle the same way. By the time I was done, I had two sock layers and two tape layers. And once my foot was laced up in the boot, my ankle and shin were protected and immobilized. Satisfied, I did up my left foot, and an hour later, it was as though both my lower legs were sunk into soft casts. It still hurt to walk, but the torture that I'd felt when my ankle moved was more tolerable. Or at least I thought so. I'd find out for sure when we started to run. Our first training run that day was my trial by fire, and I did the best I could to run with my hip flexors. Usually we let our feet and lower legs drive the rhythm. I had to reverse that. It took intense focus to isolate each movement and generate motion and power in my legs from the hip down. And for the first 30 minutes, the pain was the worst I'd ever felt in my life. The tape cut into my skin, while the pounding sent shockwaves of agony up my slivered shins. And this was just the first run in what promised to be 5 months of continual pain. Was it possible to survive this, day after day? I thought about quitting. If failure was my future, and I'd have to rethink my life completely, what was the point of this exercise? Why delay the inevitable? Was I fucked in the head? Each and every thought boiled down to the same old simple question. Why? The only way to guarantee failure is to quit right now, motherfucker. I was talking to myself now, silently screaming over the din of anguish that was crushing my mind and soul. Take the pain, or it won't just be your failure, it will be your family's failure. I imagined the feeling I would have if I could actually pull this off, if I could endure the pain required to complete this mission. That bought me another half mile before more pain rained down and swirled within me like a typhoon. People have a hard time going through Bud's healthy, and you're going through it on broken legs. Who else would even think of this, I asked. Who else would be able to run even 1 minute on one broken leg, let alone two? Only Goggins. You are 20 minutes in the business, Goggins. You are a fucking machine. Each step you run from now until the end will only make you harder. That last message cracked the code like a password. My calloused mind was my ticket forward, and at the 40-minute mark, something remarkable happened. The pain receded to low tide. The tape had loosened so it wasn't cutting into my skin, and my muscles and bones were warm enough to take some pounding. The pain would come and go throughout the day, but it became much more manageable, and when the pain did show up, I told myself it was proof of how tough I was and how much tougher I was becoming. Day after day, the same ritual played itself out. I showed up early, duct taped my feet, endured 30 minutes of extreme pain, talked myself through it, and survived. This was no fake it till you make it bullshit. To me, the fact that I showed up every day, willing to put myself through something like that, was truly amazing. The instructors rewarded me for it, too. They offered to bind my hands and feet and throw me in the pool to see if I could swim 4 fucking laps. In fact, they didn't offer. They insisted. This was one part of an evolution they like to call drown-proofing. I preferred to call it controlled drowning. With our hands bound behind us and feet tied behind our back, all we could do is dolphin kick. And unlike some of the experienced swimmers in our class, who looked like they'd been pulled from the Michael Phelps gene pool, my dolphin kick was that of a stationary rocking horse and provided about the same propulsion. I was continually out of breath, fighting to stay near the surface, chicken-necking my head above the water to get a breath, only to sink down and kick hard, trying in vain to find momentum. I'd practiced for this. For weeks, I'd hit the pool and even experimented with wetsuit shorts to see if I could hide them under my uniform to provide some buoyancy. They made it look like I was wearing a diaper under the tight-ass, nut-hugging UDT shorts, and they didn't help. But all that practice did get me comfortable enough with the feeling of drowning that I was able to endure and pass that test. We had another brutal underwater evolution in second phase, aka dive phase. Again, it involved treading water, which always sounds basic as hell whenever I write it. But for this drill, we were fitted with fully charged, twin 80-liter tanks and a 16-pound weight belt. We had fins, but kicking with fins increased the pain quotient and stress on my ankles and shins. I couldn't tape up for the water. I had to suck up the pain. After that, we had to swim on our backs for 50 meters without sinking, then flip over and swim 50 meters on our stomach, once again staying on the surface, all while being fully loaded. We weren't allowed to use any flotation devices whatsoever, and keeping our heads up caused intense pain in our necks, shoulders, hips, and lower backs. The noises coming out of the pool that day are something I'll never forget. Our desperate attempts to stay afloat and breathe conjured an audible mixture of terror, frustration, and exertion. We were gurgling, grunting, and gasping. I heard guttural screams and high-pitched squeals. Several guys sunk to the bottom, took off their weight belts, and slipped free of their tanks, letting them crash to the floor of the pool, then jetted to the surface. Only one man passed that evolution on the first try. We only got 3 chances to pass any given evolution, and it took me all 3 to pass that one. On my last attempt, I focused on long, fluid scissor kicks, again using my overworked hip flexors. I barely made it. By the time we got to third phase, the land warfare training module on San Clemente Island, my legs were healed up, and I knew I'd make it through to graduation. But just because it was the last lap doesn't mean it was easy. At the main Buds compound on the Strand, you get lots of looky-loos coming through. Officers of all stripes stop in to watch training, which means there are people peering over the instructor's shoulders. On the island, it's just you and them. They are free to get nasty, and they show no mercy, which is exactly why I loved the island. One afternoon, we split into teams of 2 and 3 guys to build hide sites that blend in with the vegetation. We were coming down to the end by then, and everyone was in killer shape and unafraid. Guys were getting sloppy with their attention to detail, and the instructors were pissed off, so they called everyone down into a valley to give us a classic beatdown. There would be push-ups, sit-ups, flutter kicks, and 8-count bodybuilders galore. But first they told us to kneel down and dig holes with our hands, large enough to bury ourselves up to the neck for some unspecified length of time. I was smiling my ass off and digging deep when one of the instructors came up with a new, creative way to torture me. "Goggins, get up. You like this shit too much." I laughed and kept digging, but he was serious. I said, "Get up, Goggins. You're getting way too much pleasure." I stood up, stepped to the side, and watched my classmates suffer for the next 30 minutes without me. From then on, the instructors stopped including me in their beatdowns. When the class was ordered to do push-ups, sit-ups, or get wet and sandy, they'd always exclude me. I took it as a point of pride that I'd finally broken the will of the entire Bud staff, but I also missed the beatdowns, because I saw them as opportunities to callous my mind. Now, they were over for me. Considering that the grinder was center stage for a lot of Navy SEAL training, it makes sense that's where Bud's graduation is held. Families fly in. Fathers and brothers puff their chests out. Mothers, wives, and girlfriends are all done up and drop dead gorgeous. Instead of pain and misery, It was all smiles on that patch of asphalt as the graduates of class 235 mustered up in our dress whites beneath a huge American flag billowing in the sea breeze. To our right was the infamous bell that 130 of our classmates tolled in order to quit what is arguably the most challenging training in the military. Each of us was introduced and acknowledged individually. My mother had tears of joy in her eyes when my name was called. But strangely, I didn't feel much of anything except sadness. On the Grinder and later at Mick P's, the SEAL pub of choice in downtown Coronado, my teammates beamed with pride as they gathered to take photos with their families. At the bar, music blared while everyone got drunk and raised hell like they just won something. And to be honest, that shit annoyed me, because I was sorry to see buds go. When I first locked in on the SEALs, I was looking for an arena that would either destroy me completely or make me unbreakable. Buds provided that. It showed me what the human mind is capable of and how to harness it to take more pain than I'd ever felt before, so I could learn to achieve things I never even knew were possible, like running on broken legs. After graduation, it would be up to me to continue to hunt impossible tasks, because though it was an accomplishment to become just the 36th African-American Buds graduate in Navy SEAL history, my quest to defy the odds had only just begun. My man, that is crazy. The running on broken legs, that's what we were referencing before the Dobbs stuff.
Right.
I mean, that is just unreal, man. When I heard that, I was just like, wow, I am such a pussy.
Well, see, what happened is my mentality started growing by leaps and bounds.
Yeah.
And you'll see in these next coming chapters how far my mind starts to go.
Yeah.
And that also starts to hurt me.
Yeah.
That also starts to hurt me coming up, man. I start to, you know, start to dive into parts of the mind that many people have never even explored, have never even done anything is even possible. And I was starting to tap into these different spots that I was like, my God, the mind is truly amazing.
It reminds me of, do you remember that season Kobe played like with a bad wrist the entire season? Like he had a torn ligament in his wrist the whole season or something
right,
like that.
Right.
Remember that?
Yep.
Yeah, it reminds me of that, you know, like, because at the time we all knew he was doing that. But like, I don't even feel like that got as much play as it probably should have.
Right. And you know what's funny? I hear about those things and I sometimes laugh.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Because I know these people went through some serious stuff, you know, but I'm literally going through the hardest training, you know, arguably in the world.
Right. With no big health staff babying
right.
you after
you know,
a 2-hour game.
I don't have like ice baths and shit.
No.
You know, I'm in the daggone cage putting duct tape on my daggone ankles and feet. And you know, it's excruciating. And I'm hoping to get, you know, in the Pacific Ocean because it was cold. So I was hoping to get in that water so my body would get frozen. So that would also help with, it was actually numb. It actually numbed my feet.
Fuck yeah. I mean, you're still on a fucking a reserve salary.
Exactly.
You're not even getting a full SEAL salary.
No, man. So this ain't like Kobe Bryant
no.
shit, man. This is like, you know, I'm sitting here thinking,
this
man.
This is caveman.
Yeah, this is straight up barbaric.
This is caveman.
Savage,
yeah.
Like next level Garanimal shit.
I mean, what's the difference in pay? Like how much were you making and how much were you hoping to get just by running on broken legs?
So basically, I was in E5, I believe, I was in E4. So I was in E4 and I was probably bringing home, going through Buds, about $2,200 a month.
And then if you got through Buds, what was your payday?
I was going to get, I was part of the STAR program. So I was going to go from E4 to E5, which jumped my pay up. I was going to get dive pay and jump pay and demo pay. So that was going to jack my pay up from about $2,200 a month to damn near $4,500, you know, double my pay.
Which is great, but it's not Kobe Bryant game pay.
No, not at all, man. And, you know, plus going through Buds, your legs, that's almost 100% of what you're doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was very different. And there was no, you know, really days off.
Yeah, man.
You know,
that's what I'm saying, man. When I hear your story, that's all I can think about is is who are the people out there going through stuff you just can't even imagine? You know what I mean? And like that and fighting for it. You know, it's actually life affirming to hear you, all that you had to go through and you achieved and you got through it. It's like, that's why I'm motivated by your story. And I think a lot of people are, because it shows you that it's possible to go through shit you can't even imagine.
Well, what's funny is some of the hardest people on the planet Earth, you'll never hear about.
No.
So we idolize these sport figures.
Yeah.
You know, because they have a broken toenail or they have plantar fasciitis. You know, oh my God, you know, like Peyton Manning, he has plantar fasciitis. I know a million ultra runners who every day run with plantar fasciitis.
Right, right.
So it's just how we, you know, we idolize these people and just these old school knuckle draggers, these everyday men and women who are getting after it, who are hard as shit. And it's like, hey, whatever, man. Just get up and do something that sucks every day. They don't care.
No, amazing. Well, let's do a couple behind the scenes on the SEALs that we didn't, you know, we're going to get into more SEAL stuff as you go. But, you know, with your deployments, but, some of the guys that aren't in the deployments either that we want to highlight, I think there was Drew Sheets and we wanted to give some backstory, as well to some other guys.
So with Drew Sheets was in my third Hell Week and he was my Bill Brown. So Bill Brown was in my second Hell Week. Drew Sheets was in my third Hell Week and he was my pillar beside me. He was the guy that was like, look, so the front of the boat is extremely heavy.
He was Bill Brown for your third Hell Week.
Exactly. He was my Bill Brown for my third Hell Week. And he was the guy. I was number one guy. The number one position on the boat is the front of the boat is heavy as shit. Number two is about the second heaviest spot, which is also the front of the boat. And basically, we both got out of Hell Week. And it was like, what? It was we got out Thursday morning and we were both on crutches. And we both have broken legs. But the thing with Drew Sheets is that Drew couldn't continue on. This is Drew's first class. Mm. This is my third class. So Drew actually got rolled back, I think, to class either 236 or 237. And Drew couldn't believe that I was going on because we both had the same amount. You know, we had a high number of breaks in our shins. And I was like, hey, I gotta keep on going, dude. So that's Drew Sheets. We have Bill Brown from my second Hell Week. And a great story about Bill Brown was in his first class, he was in dive phase, and Bill got beat a lot. Push-ups, sit-ups, stuff like that. You know, the instructors just didn't like Bill Brown.
Yeah.
So there was one time that Bill got in trouble, or they didn't like him for whatever reason, and they made him do 8-count bodybuilders, and they forgot about him. And he was in the back by second phase, in a location where you could easily get, you know, forgotten about. And Bill was back there for a few hours doing 8-count bodybuilders. And the class went to chow. The class came back. The class did some stuff. And like, hey, do a muster. A muster's like, hey, you know, like, you know, basically like a head count.
Mm.
So they did a muster and they couldn't find Bill Brown. And the instructor remembered, oh my God, I had him do 8-count bodybuilders. So he was expecting to see Bill Brown just kind of sitting back there chilling out. He went back there hours later and Freak Brown is still busting out 8-count bodybuilders, man. Hours later. Hmm. Nobody watching him. Totally accountable. So that was a great story about Bill Brown. And you know about Kenny Bigby, man. So we interviewed all these guys and you can share some stories about Kenny Bigby. And I have some also.
Yeah. I think the story that I like the best is, so Kenny Bigby, he was a competitive martial artist. His dad had a dojo, also in Indianapolis, correct?
Yeah, we both actually, I went to North Central for probably about a half the year, maybe a little bit less. Kenny Bigby went to North Central 2 years after I did.
And he's like worshiping Bruce Lee and all that. And he was a great martial artist. And then he ends up, also was a great dancer. I mean, he was just a great athlete. And, the story I remember him telling us was that he basically had maybe $100 or $200 to his name and he got in a van with a bunch of guys
yep.
And they came out to California to try to make it in, you know, music videos and in Hollywood doing the dancing thing. And he was getting by. He was literally homeless in LA getting by doing dance shows on the Venice boardwalk. You know, those guys that do the kind of the flip shows and the hip hop breakdancing shows. And he was living that way. And he ended up making, you know, getting some money together, getting some jobs and getting a place. But I just found it so fascinating that he was out there for the better part of a year and then ends up joining up in the Navy. I just found it fascinating. Like, you just never, that's another one. You just never know who you're interacting with, who you're seeing, and the capacity that these guys have. And I just love Kenny's story about that. And he's just fucking hilarious.
Oh man, Kenny is he was a funny dude. Oh, he is a funny guy. And there was one time going through Buds. I think it was, it was in my second Hell Week. I mean, it was like freezing outside and the instructor's like, "Hey, Kenny, do the backspin."
Mm.
"Hey, do the backspin." So this guy is on the sand in the beach doing the backspin breakdancing. It was hilarious, man. He's busted out Electric Boogaloo type shit.
I mean, it's amazing. And I loved him telling the story about, David Goggins is back on the log. I mean, I wish we could have bottled that for this, man.
It was great, man. Yeah, I should have brought Kenny in here, man. Put him on the mic. Because he tells it better than anybody, man.
No, no one can tell that story.
No,
like him.
Not like Kenny. And he has that crazy voice.
Yeah, he does all the voices. So shout out Big B.
Yes, sir.
All right, cool. So now we're getting ready to get into Chapter 6, and we're going to switch gears. I mean, the SEALs are always still in it, and you'll be in it all the way through, but now we switch gears a little bit.
Now we can't forget about the Challenge 5 here for these folks.
Oh, sorry about that.
All good.
Challenge 5. It's time to visualize. Again, the average person thinks 2,000 to 3,000 thoughts per hour. Rather than focusing on bullshit you cannot change, imagine visualizing the things you can. Choose any obstacle in your way, or set a new goal and visualize overcoming or achieving it. Before I engage in any challenging activity, I start by painting a picture of what my success looks and feels like. I'll think about it every day, and that feeling propels me forward when I'm training, competing, or taking on any task I choose. But visualization isn't simply about daydreaming of some trophy ceremony, real or metaphorical. You must also visualize the challenges that are likely to arise and determine how you will attack those problems when they do. That way you can be as prepared as possible on the journey. When I show up for a foot race now, I drive the entire course first, visualizing success but also potential challenges, which helps me control my thought process. You can't prepare for everything, but if you engage in strategic visualization ahead of time, you'll be as prepared as you possibly can be. That also means being prepared to answer the simple questions. Why are you doing this? What is driving you toward this achievement? Where does the darkness you're using as fuel come from? What has calloused your mind? You'll need to have those answers at your fingertips when you hit a wall of pain and doubt. To push through, you'll need to channel your darkness, feed off it, and lean on your calloused mind. Remember, visualization will never compensate for work undone. You cannot visualize lies. All the strategies I employ to answer the simple questions and win the mind game are only effective because I put in work. It's a lot more than mind over matter. It takes relentless self-discipline to schedule suffering into your day, every day. But if you do, you'll find that at the other end of that suffering is a whole other life just waiting for you. This challenge doesn't have to be physical, and victory doesn't always mean you came in first place. It can mean you finally overcome a lifelong fear or any other obstacle that made you surrender in the past. Whatever it is, tell the world your story about how you created your hashtag armored mind and where it's taken you. I always find this interesting because I mentioned it before, but like, I've been in these circuit training, and in circuit training, they like to push you. You want to get into the red for periods and get back into the orange and get into the red, you know, heart rate zones. And I'm able to do it because I visualize you. But when I'm on running by myself and I'm in pain, it's so hard to actually think of the simple answers to the questions. It's actually really hard to do it because to take that extra energy that it takes to think intellectual thoughts and that kind of problem solving.
Right.
It's super hard. Like, and so what's a good shortcut to make sure those answers, I mean, do you have to like really focus on them before you start the run, or how do you make sure they're at the forefront of your mind? Cause it's more complex than just remembering them.
It's huge. So one thing I started doing is I started realizing that when you're trying to go back through all these different tools that you have, your mind starts to become kind of spastic. Like you said, For instance, you were running some, you know, like your brain gets out of control, starts losing control of what's going on.
Yeah.
You have to learn. It's called the 1 second decision. And it's something that I have taken on board. It's something that I invented for myself because I would spaz out. And like, for instance, in Navy SEAL training, when they put your ass in that cold water after the first hour of breakout, they put you in there and that first wave of, you know, wave from the ocean goes over your head and you're frozen and you start to spaz out. So all that visualization, all that self-talk, all those nice tools that we have, they're out the door. You have to kind of calm your mind down that 1 second versus panicking and spazzing out. Take time to literally be patient, calm down, and get trained. Just like regain your thought process.
How do you do that when you're in the midst of a run, like you're running in the red
you heart have rate to zone? You have to slow your heart rate down.
Okay.
So when you're going fast, going too fast actually kind of makes you even more spazzed out.
Okay.
So you have to slow down your tempo, and in slowing down your tempo, it relaxes your mind.
So it's okay to slow down the tempo, because then if you can start to control your mind, then when you speed back up, you'll be in better control.
Exactly. So when the heart rate goes up, everything starts to speed up. You have to try to slow your heart rate down in that moment, whether it's slowing down running or even slowing down your thought process. If you have a really fast thought process, that will speed your heart rate up because it makes your adrenaline flow through your body. So you got to try to calm all that down in that 1 second when your mind's going fast, your body's going fast, your heart rate's up high. Calm it down and try to calm down your thoughts and think logically versus in that panic mode.
Gotcha. And I love how you describe visualization, because a lot of people think athletes or anyone who employs visualization like this, strategic visualization, usually it's focused on just the game itself and visualizing success afterwards. No one really talks about the steps like you do here, visualizing each step of the process and all the problems. So it's not just visualizing success and projecting some success you're trying to manifest. It's actually visualizing the actual problems, doing research on the problems so that you can then be prepared for them.
That's right. So you'll hear here pretty soon about me doing these different races. And without visualizing the issues that are going to come up, there's going to be issues. Like whenever you run as far as I run, or, you know, whatever I do, there's going to be issues that come up. So you have to visualize, okay, at about mile 24, 25, 35, 45, this and this and this, you know, this might happen. Mm. And if you don't account for the might happen, when it does happen, you're not going to know what to do.